There's an old saying that a picture is worth a thousand words. If you notice on the back of your bulletins today, in the place of the sermon outline, there is a picture. Now, I'm not going to substitute the thousand words, which would be about the length of my sermon, with this picture. Sorry to disappoint you. But I want to use that picture to illustrate the truth of our message this morning. And for those who may hear this message later, it is also included in the printed form of this message. Maybe you've seen shopping carts like this at the grocery store or at Walmart. In fact, there's a commercial on TV right now for Volkswagen that uses carts just like this. You have a regular shopping cart, but at the front of it, it looks like a car, and a child can sit in it, and there's a little steering wheel. Notice that girl has two steering wheels. And they can pretend that they're steering that cart. Now, you'll notice I have entitled that picture, "The Illusion of Control." Because in the eyes of the little girl riding in the car section, she might think that she's controlling the movement of that car, right? I mean, she's got the wheel. You know, I've never looked that close. I don't know if they have a little accelerator on there. You know, she puts her foot down and the cart moves forward. They get to the end of the aisle and she turns the wheel and then the cart turns. And she's thinking, hey, I've got this thing under control. So when the cart gets to the candy section and she's turning this way, but mom's going to the produce section, she's turning furiously, but the cart's going that way. Why isn't it going toward the candy? It's the illusion of control. So what does that have to do with us? Well, this morning we're going to conclude our series of messages on stress fractures. And I want to address a subject that causes many people stress, but they don't even know it. The issue is the issue of control. And while many people who desire to have control over their surroundings think that they're avoiding stress, they're actually adding more stress to their lives. Sometimes a person with control issues is referred to as a perfectionist. Yeah, that doesn't sound too bad. Or if you're talking about leadership, they might call them a micromanager. Now, those are just simply ways to maybe be nice about it, because those with less tact simply call them control freaks. You know, you can actually look up control freak in the dictionary. It's really there. Webster defines it as a person whose behavior indicates a powerful need to control people or circumstances in everyday matters. Did you catch that? A person whose behavior indicates a powerful need to control people or circumstances in everyday matters. Not just certain things, not just once in a while, but in everyday matters, they need to be in control. And oftentimes, this behavior includes manipulation. Manipulation has been defined as the art of controlling people or circumstances by indirect, unfair, or deceptive means, especially to one's own advantage. Did you see the connection there? It's all about controlling people and circumstances in our lives. Someone else has defined a control freak as one who does inappropriate things to manage the outcome of a situation. In their eyes, the end justifies the means, so as long as I get to where I want it to be, how I get there doesn't matter. Now, where does this come from? Actually, attempts to control our world begins with the first breath of life. See, when a baby doesn't get its way, what does it do? It cries. Now, I understand for a baby, that's the only way it can voice its opinion. But it is trying to control its circumstances. They're trying to get their needs met. Now, over the years, they learn how to speak. They learn how to communicate in other ways. And unfortunately, they also learn manipulative ways, sometimes through tears, sometimes through tantrums. And it's all a way of controlling the circumstances, controlling the people, usually mom and dad, to get what they want. It starts very early. Then as we grow into adults, we develop highly refined skills for meeting our needs by taking matters into our own hands and manipulating people and events around us. Now, all that probably sounds rather negative, but not everybody sees it that way. Some people look at that as, that's good management. Or those people have, they've got good people skills because they can get them to do what they want. I think it was Harry Truman that said, leadership is getting somebody else to do what you want and make them think it's their idea. And in some circles, that's thought of as pretty positive. For many years, there's a poem that's been hailed and often quoted as the epitome of the conquering spirit of man. Maybe you've heard it before. The name is Invictus. Out of the night that covers me, black as the pit, from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced nor cried aloud. Under the bludgeonings of chance, my head is bloodied but unbowed. Beyond this place of wrath and tears looms but the horror of the shade, and yet the menace of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll, I am the master of my fate, I am the captain of my soul. Now the Bible takes a very different stand on this matter. Those who think they are in control are really living a delusion. Daniel chapter 4 records the experience of one man who was, our definition, a control freak. And he had to learn things the hard way. His name was Nebuchadnezzar. Beginning in Daniel 4, verse 28, we read, all this happened to King Nebuchadnezzar. 12 months later, as the king was walking on the roof of his royal palace in Babylon, he said, is not this the great Babylon I have built as the royal residence by my mighty power and for the glory of my majesty? The words were still on his lips when a voice came from heaven. This is what is decreed for you, King Nebuchadnezzar. Your royal authority has been taken from you. You will be driven away from people and will live with the wild animals. You will eat grass like cattle. 7 years will pass by for you until you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over the kingdoms of men and gives them to anyone he wishes. Immediately what was said about Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled. He was driven away from people. He ate grass like cattle. His body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair grew like the feathers of an eagle and his nails like the claws of a bird. At the end of that time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven and my sanity was restored. Then I praised the Most High. I honored and glorified Him who lives forever. His dominion is an eternal dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the peoples of the earth are regarded as nothing. He does as he pleases with the powers of heaven. You see, Nebuchadnezzar was living a delusion. He was living the delusion that he was in charge. He was living the words of that poem, I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. He thought he had it all going. He had it all under control. And God said, not so fast, my friend. Doesn't work that way. Let me show you who's really in charge. And Nebuchadnezzar had to learn the hard way. And there are some other examples. Jesus tells a parable in Luke 12 about a man who probably about this time of year had a great harvest, more than he expected. And he said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll build bigger barns. I'll build bigger silos. I'm going to fill it up. I've got so much. I can kick back and take it easy. Life is good. And God said to him, well, you forgot about one thing. You're not immortal. You die tonight, and then what? What is all that going to gain you? He thought he had it all under control. God says, you have nothing under control. He was living the delusion of a control freak. This morning, though, I want to focus our attention on one man in the Bible who really personifies this problem, but we also see how he was cured of that problem. Max Lucado describes him as the riverboat gambler of the patriarchs, a master of sleight of hand and fancy footwork. He had gained a seamy reputation of getting what he wanted by hook or by crook or both. For him, the ends always justified the means. His cleverness was outranked only by his audacity. His conscience was calloused enough to let him sleep, and his feet were just fast enough to keep him one step ahead of the consequences. Now, I'm referring to Jacob, described by another Old Testament author as an Old Testament persuader who had also learned to make his living by his wits. He had a sharp mind, a silver tongue, and absolutely no scruples. You know, Jacob's name literally means he grasps the heel, and that's kind of like he pulls your leg. He was a deceiver. He was a cheater. That's what his name meant. And he certainly lived down to that reputation. He admits in Genesis 27:11, "Behold, Esau, my brother, is a hairy man, and I am a smooth man." Now, I know what he was saying in the context. You know, Esau was like a human rug. You know, he was hairy. He was manly. Had a deep voice. And Jacob was a wimp. Jacob couldn't grow hair on his arms. I mean, he was a mama's boy. And I know he was talking about his appearance, that he was a smooth man. But there's more to it than that. Jacob was indeed a very smooth operator. He was the one that could talk him in and out of trouble. He could pull the wool over people's eyes. He did it quite literally to his dad. He was a cheat. But he was, more than that, a control freak. He did everything to manipulate people and events to get things his way. He controlled by manipulation and by deception, or so he thought. I think there's a fascinating use of the name Jacob. It's in a verse you've heard before. Jeremiah 17:9. I know I've quoted it. "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked." You say, well, I didn't hear the name Jacob there. In the Hebrew, it says the heart is Jacob. That's the word used in the Hebrew. The heart is deceitful, manipulative, corrupt. The heart is a control freak. We want everything done our way. We want to have it our way. That's part of our human nature. Now, this delusion of thinking we're in control, it's not limited to just a few people back in the Bible times. It comes from that sin nature, that selfishness that's so deep inside of us, we're even unaware of how corrupt we really are. Now, with this delusion comes a great deal of distress, which is why this subject falls under the heading of stress fractures. Ironically, a control freak seeks to lessen stress by managing and manipulating people, things, and events surrounding them. But in the end, they create more stress than they alleviate. At the center of this distress is the fact that control freaks usually operate out of insecurity and fear. Now, frankly, I believe there's two kinds of control freaks. You have the one kind that they're kind of egotistical. They're a control freak because they're convinced that their way is the right way. And they want to not only control their own lives, but they want to control the lives of others too. This is like the Napoleon complex. They want to conquer others. They want more people to be under them. And there are a few people like that, and you've probably known of some. But I think there's a whole other category of control freaks. Frankly, I think there's more of these. They don't operate out of an overinflated ego. You know, they're not just trying to, you know, put another notch on their belt because over on somebody else. These are people who may genuinely have good intentions. They may want what's best, not only for themselves, but even for those around them. And they think that the only way they can do that is to make sure that the things happen their way. So they want to control all of the circumstances. Why is that? Because deep down inside, they're very insecure. You might say, wait a minute, a control freak by definition is someone that's overly sure of themselves. Not necessarily. I think many control freaks operate out of insecurity. They're afraid. They're afraid of what might happen if things get out of their control. They're afraid of what might take place if they're not calling the shots, if they're not the ones in charge. There's a lot of insecurity and fear because fear at its center is a perceived loss of control. Now, what is the opposite of fear for the Christian? Faith. So when fear comes in, faith gets crowded out. And rather than relying upon God, rather than trusting in God's providence, we start scheming. We start trusting our own resources. You look at the life of Jacob, and you find a man consumed with fear. At one point in his biography in the Bible, it says he was greatly afraid and distressed. And so what did he do? He started scheming. He started manipulating the events. He's got a plan worked out because he thinks he's got it all under control. Why? Because he was afraid. And all of our scheming and all of our manipulating, it produces more fear and anxiety. Because then we start wondering, what if I get caught? What if my plans don't work out the way I want them to? What if others get angry? And boy, you see that throughout the life of Jacob. Because frankly, he ticked a lot of people off. He cheated a lot of people. When you cheat a lot of people, they don't like that. And that created an awful lot of stress. I'm thinking that if he had had the chance back then, if you saw Jacob today, he'd be wearing a pair of Air Jordans because he was always on the run. He was always running from somebody. And usually it was somebody he had tried to manipulate and control. You think about Jacob's schemes. He got his birthright from his brother Esau by manipulating his brother's hunger. He got the blessing from his father by impersonating Esau and lying about it. When he ran away from home because Esau wanted to kill him, understandably, he went to his uncle's house, Uncle Laban, and boy, he met the master. Laban was every bit as much a control freak and manipulator as Jacob, and boy, they went back and forth. They were constantly trying to get over on each other. Jacob fell in love with Laban's daughter, Rachel, wanted to marry her. Laban said, "That's wonderful. Love to have you as part of the family. I'll tell you what, you work 7 years for me, you can have Rachel. And I won't make you wait. You can marry her now, but you're going to pledge me 7 years." Now, I take that back. He worked the 7 years. He worked the 7 years. Wedding day comes. Going to marry the girl of my dreams. He gets up there, marries her. Oops, it's not Rachel. Laban had snuck in his rather unattractive daughter that he couldn't get married off, got her in there. Oh, well, you know, we have this custom here that, you know, the older sister doesn't get married after the younger sister, so, you know, just the way it is. I'll tell you what, give me 7 more years and you can have Rachel. See how Laban schemed Jacob there? Oh, Jacob got back at him. Oh, yeah. I mean, you go through and it's almost comical to see how these guys are trying to get back and forth on each other. Finally, he had to leave Laban because Laban couldn't take it anymore. So he comes back. And his whole life, he's on the run constantly. Now, on the surface, it appears that he got over, that he came out on top. But what did it cost him? You know, in fear of his brother and maybe even his father, I mentioned Jacob had to leave home initially. G. Campbell Morgan puts it this way, "For Jacob, the harvest of his actions consisted in this enforced absence from his home. As we have seen in the scriptures, he was a quiet man. He was a dweller in tents. He was a homebody, differing from Esau. To him, home meant far more than it did his brother. And being separated from his mother, and he was very close to his mother, this flight away from home cost him much. That his mother suffered in all those years is evident from the words she said when he sent him away. Now, her plan was that he was just going to be gone a short time until his brother cooled off. But the scripture records that he never came back in her lifetime. He was gone 21 years, and during that time, his mother died. So while it looks like he got the better of his brother, and he got the better of his father, and he got all the stuff that he wanted, he lost his relationship to his mother. He had to run away from home, and he was a homebody. That cost him a great deal. We don't tend to think about that side. And control freaks usually don't. They don't think about the consequences. They're only looking at how they can be in control. And when you think about it, all those years that he spent in exile, his life could hardly have been a happy one. He was working like a slave for his uncle Laban. When you get into the story of the competition between his wives, Leah and Rachel, they were playing him like a used deck of cards. You wonder why Jacob had 12 sons? Read the story sometime. It's because these two wives were going back and forth at each other. And Rachel was the favored wife, but she couldn't have children, and Leah could. When Leah found out she could have children, she was popping them out as fast as she could. And all of the names of her sons, they were rubbing it in Rachel's face. Reuben, see, a son. Every time she called for Reuben, she was rubbing it in the face of Rachel that I've got kids and you don't. She had 4 or 5 before Rachel finally said, fine, if I can't have kids, maybe my maidservant can. And it turns out Jacob has those 12 sons by 4 different women who honestly couldn't stand each other. You know, all of this control that he thought he had none. He couldn't even control his own family. He resorted to these superstitious practices in order to get over on his uncle. He was a mess. All of this distress for someone who worked so hard at controlling every person and every circumstance for his own benefit. And for all of that struggle, he found himself at odds with everyone around him, and that's something control freaks usually do. They're usually at odds with everyone around them. But more than anything, Jacob was at odds with God. By insisting on controlling his surroundings, Jacob refused to allow God be in control of them. And that is ultimately a lack of faith. Not only was this futile, I mean, can man really take control away from God? But it was also foolish. You know, Jacob must have known from his mother about the promise God had made about him. You see, Jacob and Esau were twins. And while his mother, Rebekah, was carrying the twins, she was having a rough time. It was a rough pregnancy. The boys were already fighting each other in the womb. And Rebekah went to God and said, God, what's going on here? And God answered her. And God gave her a promise and said, the elder will serve the younger. Now, that didn't happen in that society. You know, the firstborn got all the benefits. But God said, the younger one is the one that I'm going to bless. And you know Rebekah remembered that, and I'm sure at some point Rebekah had told Jacob that. Yet neither Rebekah nor Jacob took the promise seriously enough. They knew the promise enough to know that they expected Jacob to be blessed, but both of them lacked trust that God would give what he had promised. So instead, they took matters into their own hands. And they played on Esau's weaknesses, on Isaac's blindness. They worked by hook or by crook. But you know what the bottom line was? In these ways, Jacob struggled half his life to gain the things that God had already promised to give him. All the things that Jacob got by deception and manipulation and control, God already wanted to give it to him. If he had simply trusted God, God would have brought it about. In the end, he got exactly what God had promised, but no more. But tragically, he had missed in this struggle the peace and the fellowship with God that he would have enjoyed. God wanted him to have the inheritance, plus the peace, plus the fellowship with God and with his family. But instead, Jacob had 21 years of anxiety, of misery, of fear. Was he really in control? No. Are we? I'm reminded of the words of that familiar hymn, "Oh, what peace we often forfeit. Oh, what needless pain we bear, all because we do not carry everything to God in prayer." Same thing can be said for Jacob. Same thing can be said for any control freak. We forfeit the peace that God wants to give us. We forfeit the fellowship that we have with Him. We ruin relationships. And if we carry it too far, we can ruin our own health. Because we add so much stress to our bodies. And for what? Nothing more or less than God had planned all along. Now, how much easier, how much better it is to let God be in control. Well, fortunately, Jacob's story has a happy ending. Genesis 32 records an encounter between Jacob and a stranger that changed his life forever. It's probably a story you've heard before. We're going to begin in verse 22. That night Jacob got up and took his two wives, his two maidservants, and his 11 sons, 12th one hadn't been born yet, and crossed the ford of the river. After he had sent them across the stream, he sent over all his possessions. So Jacob was left alone. And a man wrestled with him until daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower Jacob, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, "Let go of me, for it is daybreak." But Jacob replied, "I will not let go of you until you bless me." The man asked him, "What is your name?" "Jacob," he answered. Then the man said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with men and have overcome." Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." But the man replied, "Why do you ask my name?" Then he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "It is because I saw God face to face, yet my life was spared." The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the Israelites do not eat the tendon attached to the socket of the hip, because of the socket of Jacob's hip was touched near the tendon. In this account, we see the deliverance of a control freak. And it involved three steps. The first was confrontation. You know, we often think of this event as Jacob wrestling with God, which is true, but it gives the impression that Jacob picked the fight. And that's not true. According to the text, a man wrestled with Jacob. Somebody came and confronted him. Now, why did God confront Jacob there? In the words of A.W. Tozer, it was to save Jacob from deceptive hope that God confronted him that night on the bank of the river. To save him from self-trust, it was necessary for God to conquer him, to wrest control away from him, to take his great power and rule with the rod of love. Though God initiated the confrontation, don't think of him as being vindictive or mean here. Picture the wrestling as God seeking to help Jacob understand something. Picture him as urging upon Jacob truths that Jacob was unwilling to see. Picture him as they struggle trying to convince Jacob that he means him no harm, that his intentions are not malicious, that they're merciful. In the words of Jeremiah 29:11, I have plans for you, plans to prosper you, not to harm you, plans for a hope and a future. But see, Jacob's too afraid. All of his life, he's learned only one lesson. It is safe to trust no one but yourself. Jacob must fight his own battle, so he wrestles on. He's terrified into unyielding. Now, you read the text, and it seems like this fight is coming to a draw. It's going to come into a tie. No one's winning. Incredibly, the text records that the man could not overpower Jacob. You think, really? He's wrestling with God and God can't get the better of him? Is that really what's going on here? We later discovered that this man was either the angel of the Lord or maybe the Lord himself. So do you think that Jacob was really so strong that God could not overpower him? I don't think so, because I don't think this was an issue of physical strength. The struggle of Jacob and God here was a struggle for control. And I think Jacob wanted to control God. And God wanted to control Jacob. That's what this wrestling boiled down to. Jacob discovered that he could not control God because God can't be manipulated like everybody else Jacob had manipulated. But God could not control Jacob, or maybe I should say he would not control Jacob, because God doesn't take mankind's freedom to make choices for himself. He doesn't force his control onto people. He wants them to give him the control of their lives. Now, the second step in this deliverance was confession. The man asked Jacob, "What is your name?" I remember as a little boy, this man in our church would come up and say, "Hi, Scott, what's your name?" Drove me nuts. You just said it. "What's your name, Scott?" Oh, just drove me crazy. And you think, wait a minute, God knows this guy's name. You know, why are you asking my name? It was a confession. Because remember what Jacob's name meant? Cheater. Manipulator. And for Jacob to say, "My name is cheat. My name is manipulator. My name is control freak." He was confessing something about himself. He was admitting, "My name, my game is cheating, manipulating, and controlling." And before God can change us, we must confess who we really are. Until we can honestly admit what we've been, let's call it for what it is, we've been playing God. Control freaks try to play God. They want to be in control. Until we can admit that, we'll never come to a place where we'll be changed. I am told that the greatest obstacle for those addicted to drugs and alcohol is admitting that they have a problem. The same is true for those addicted to control. And when that happens, we see a third step in the process, and that's conversion. God not only changed his name from Jacob to Israel, but he changed Jacob's life as well. Now, at first, this might seem rather cruel and heartless. But when God crippled Jacob, it was an act of grace and mercy. G. Campbell Morgan calls this the crippling that crowns. He interprets the name Israel to mean a God-mastered man. See, this limp became a blessing because through it, God showed Jacob that his only hope was to depend on him. Jacob's limp was a reminder that he lacked the strength to orchestrate life on his own terms. If nothing else, he couldn't run away anymore from the consequences of his actions because he literally couldn't run. Jacob said, I will not let go until you bless me. And you know, those were words God had been waiting for over 40 years to hear. God had wanted to bless him all this time. Jacob wouldn't let him. And now Jacob is saying, I must have your blessing. Now, I'm sure God would have preferred that Jacob had learned that a long time before. I don't think he wanted to reduce him to being a cripple, but that's what it took. Is God wrestling with us today? See, he doesn't want to bring us down to that level, but if that's what it takes, he will. And he may allow things to come into our lives that break us down. I heard somebody give a testimony one time and said, I never looked up until I was flat on my back and had no other choice. And sometimes that will happen. It happened with Jacob. See, if we trust God first, we avoid a whole lot of pain. If we come to the place of realizing that we have no hope except in Him, then we can allow Him to control and we will lose that sense in ourselves. Tozer concludes, the Lord cannot fully bless a man until he has first conquered him. The degree of blessing enjoyed by any man will correspond exactly with the completeness of God's victory over him. So what's the antidote for a control freak? It comes when we firmly grasp the reality and the consequences of this truth. God is calling the shots, not me. Proverbs 19:21 says, many are the plans in a man's heart, but it is the Lord's purpose that prevails. And the sooner we learn this, the better off we'll be. Now, this doesn't mean that we passively sit back and wait for God to do everything for us. You know, we don't become fatalistic, resigned to a philosophy that we're helpless to do anything. God calls us to act, to move in obedience to Him, but we're to leave the results to God. We cannot control our circumstances, our companions, or even the consequences of our actions. But we do control our choices, and then we can leave all those other things to God. One man wrote, knowing that I am not the one in control gives great encouragement. Knowing the one who is in control is everything. Remember that poem that I read earlier called Invictus? Well, years later, a Christian wrote a response. And this poem is entitled, My Captain. Out of the light that dazzles me, bright as the sun from pole to pole, I thank the God I know to be, for Christ, the conqueror of my soul. Since His the sway of circumstance, I will not wince nor cry aloud. Under that rule which men call chance, my head with joy is humbly bowed. Beyond this place of sin and tears, that life with Him and His the aid, despite the menace of the years, keeps and shall keep me unafraid. I have no fear, though strait the gate, He cleared the punishment from the scroll. Christ is the master of my fate. Christ is the captain of my soul. And that is the only way to peace, joy, and fulfillment in life. Don't fall victim to this stress fracture of being a control freak. Let God be God. And always remember who's really steering that cart. It's Him. Our invitation hymn this morning is hymn number 250. a great reassurance. Because the truth of the matter is, I don't know about tomorrow. I don't know what each day is going to hold. But we know who does hold tomorrow. And we know that He holds our hand. We can trust Him. We're just going to sing that first verse. Let this be your prayer and your testimony. No longer am I going to try to be in control. I want God to be in control. We're just going to sing the first verse.